I don't know if it's really 8 o'clock or not, but it appears that we don't actually have to wait for any more people to get here. I'm Ron Miller. Welcome. Thanks for getting out this early in the morning. I'm the Director of Product Management at H.W. Wilson, and allow me to welcome you officially to Less Searching, More Finding, the Future of Information Retrieval. I thought I would pull out some quotes just to lend a note of humor to this somber occasion. So I looked around and I found some things about the future that we could look at. I'll read a few now. Albert Einstein once said, "I never think of the future, it comes soon enough." One of the great minds of my time, Dwight Eisenhower, once said, "Neither a wise man nor a brave man lies down on the tracks of history to wait for the train of the future to run over him." Here's one I like. "We should all be concerned about future because we'll have to spend the rest of our lives there." That was the inventor Charles Kettering. I'll read some more as I find that things slow down.
It's so weird to start quoting. We know we're bombing.
Our first panelist is the esteemed Mary D. Ojala. In case you were wondering how to pronounce that last name, I've done considerable research, and if you want to meet afterwards, she'll give you the etymology, but that is the correct pronunciation. In case there is anybody that doesn't know, please allow me to give you some biographical notes. Mary D. edits Online, the leading magazine for information professionals. She contributes feature articles and news stories to Information Today, Searcher, eContent, Computers and Libraries, Intranets, Cyber Skeptics Guide to the Internet, Business Information Review, and Information Today's News Breaks. Her blog is onlineinsider.net. She speaks frequently at conferences such as Web Search University, Internet Librarian, Online Information, the London Online, that is, Internet Librarian International, and National Library Meetings inside and outside the U.S. She has adjunct faculty status at the School of Library and Information Science at UEPUI,
Indiana University. Would you cut that out?
Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, teaching business information resources. So, without taking up any more time, Mary D.
Got to shorten that bio for him. All of those publications that Ron noted are published by Information Today, and there are free copies of a lot of those. Not, however, online, because they ran out of all the onlines yesterday around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, "That's nice, we have two more days of this conference, and there are no more copies of online to give out," and they said, "Oh." So, the on Information Today booth is somewhere, I don't know the booth number, it's somewhere in row 800. So if you're down in the exhibit hall at some point and you're somewhere around 800, just go by and harass them. "Where's the online? I came just for that." Okay, the other thing is, my good friend Barb Brinko, who edits Information Today, the tabloid newspaper, she's always complaining when she does conference coverage that people take photographs of the audience and they all look just like you. They have very serious faces. She says, "You know, they never look like they're enjoying themselves." And so it's become my mission in life to take photographs from the podium of people smiling. And so, if you please would do that. Thank you! Okay, but what we are here to talk about is searching, finding, and my cut on this is how all this stuff relates to the information professional. The other people up here are going to have some other things to say about that. So, you know, a lot of what happens and what we've been hearing about is, are we all entering the future of 2.0? Depending on what country you're in, you may not actually call this 2.0. I've heard of this 2.0, 2.0, 2.0. It's very interesting. Just something that looks perfectly normal, and then you listen to people talk, and it comes out differently. And the whole idea of Library 2.0 is that it's going to empower our users. It's all about collaboration and conversation. And my question to you is everybody actually ready for this? We are information professionals. Is there anybody in the room who actually considers themselves totally an end user of information? Okay. We're information professionals, as I said. So why are we different? If there really is no difference in a 2.0 world between information professionals and end users, what does that mean in terms of searchability and findability? What is the future? And here's what I come up with, and this is a philosophical kind of thing, which is basically as information professionals, we just love to find information, and we like the process of finding information. We like to search. We really understand how information is structured. We can visualize things. And okay, I edit online. This is something that isn't just an online issue. One of my very first jobs was in a university library. It was in the periodicals department. And we had full professors coming in who literally did not understand how an index worked. And at that time, of course, you pulled out a paper copy of an index, possibly published by Wilson, and you'd have to explain to people how you looked things up. Well, the online world isn't that different philosophically. It's certainly different in terms of how things work. The other thing about information professionals, we're really good at sharing information among ourselves, particularly in terms of search engines, because web search changes at an astronomical pace, and frequently the companies that are giving us these search engines really don't understand. I was in the Google booth yesterday explaining to them why synonym doesn't work anymore. And they said, well, but sure it does. And I said, no, and here's why it doesn't. And I demonstrated it to the guy and told him why it was important to information professionals. He took notes. And what we do is not put 2.2 words into a search box. We use specialized sources. We know if we want this kind of information, we go to this kind of a source. We like to search, and therefore sometimes we forget to stop searching. How many of you have ever had the experience where 4 years after a reference question came across your desk, you discovered the perfect answer? You don't even remember who asked the question anymore. Well, what happens with information overload? We hear a lot about that. What really happens is that we forget to look in places that we should have looked. So we tend to overlook things. And paradoxically, as more stuff becomes available to us, the whole process takes us longer. It's not like the Industrial Revolution, when we got washing machines and we didn't have to wash by hand on a washboard and all that kind of stuff. That really was time-saving. Automation for the research process makes it longer. This is from an article by Amy Affelt that I published in the March issue of Online. And this is how the research topic was the options backdating scandals. And so you go to a student doing a paper on this, and they put options in the search box. The next one is a LexisNexis search strategy that Amy uses. Slightly different. Oops. Do that. Let me go back to the beginning here. Finding is what our clients want. They don't care how to search. They only want an answer. They don't want to hear about sources. Just get me what I want to know. And I don't understand why I can't just put the word options in a search box and get everything on backdated options from all these very specialized sources. They don't understand Boolean. They understand it more than they used to, thanks to the advanced search screens of the web search engines, but they still don't think in Boolean. I don't mean to suggest that we don't want answers. Of course we do. But information professionals want answers that are correct, that are timely, that actually answer the question. One drawback that I see with information professionals is that we tend to think about external sources before we think of internal. Sometimes the answer is inside your organization. Well, how do you orchestrate findability? And that's sort of interesting because that's what a lot of our vendors are trying to do. For one thing, they want to expand the findability out into the end user market. And so they want to do things like reputation monitoring for corporations. They want to tie in their information to the sales department. They want to get, particularly in law offices, they're really getting into back office management. One of the buzzwords I'm hearing is, well, we want to integrate with the workflow. To do that, they have to figure out what the workflow is. And then a lot of new pricing models, everything used to be subscription-based. Now we're seeing a lot of companies that are going to a pay-per-view. I found one article, use PayPal, $2.95, you're done. And the whole idea of becoming more intuitive, of trying to automate how we think, how an information professional goes about constructing a search strategy. If any of you do business research, one of the companies that's very good at doing this is 10K Wizard. And if you look at some of their predefined searches on SEC filings, they have really spent a lot of time trying to figure out the best search strategy. And believe me, it is not a search strategy that any end user would come up with. What they're trying to do is make their search look more like web search because that's what people are familiar with. What happens when we get to the web? Search is pervasive. That doesn't mean findability is pervasive, but search is everywhere. How many times, you can walk down any street in any town, rural, big city, I don't care. You'll hear a conversation that, well, yeah, I searched for that on the internet. Search is everywhere, but it's also unstable because what you found yesterday, you may or may not find today. What you find at the top of a list of results may be there because of a search engine optimizer. It might not be there because it's actually the best resource. We know that. Our end users probably do not know that because they don't realize that companies are out there basically gaming the system and saying, all I care about is that the results of my website show up at the top. So this brings quality issues to the fore, and that's something that information professionals care about, know about, and need to explain clearly to whatever constituency you have, which is, of course, the education issue that I have up here. Well, looking to the future, what is absolutely the worst-case scenario? In my mind, it's a really, really highly controlled environment. I'm appalled that paying a lot of money for our vendors doesn't always equate to quality data. If you've ever looked at Dun & Bradstreet for company information, you'll know what I mean. Industry consolidation. Every time I turn around, somebody's buying somebody else. I have to tell you that I'm not going to be pleased if, as it looks like it's going to happen, Rupert Murdoch buys Dow Jones. We have Thomson Financial buying Reuters, so we have extreme consolidation in information sources. It worries me. And the other thing that worries me is this latter point here, where is the money in web search, aside from porn? It's consumerism. It's buying stuff. And it's entertainment. It's what are the stars doing? And if that's where the money is, what happens to quality information? What happens to the kind of information that you and I need for our jobs? Here's the absolute worst case scenario. Who says librarians don't have fun. Okay, best case scenario is if we have intuitive interfaces, things that actually help us do the kinds of research that we need to do, that we don't have licensing wars where somebody says, oh, I'm going to put my journal exclusively with whoever. We want information that is accessible and available. You know, this whole thing about information wants to be free. I'm not absolutely convinced that phrase means information wants to be at no charge. It means it wants to be freely available. In a best case scenario, our producers are profitable, because if they're not profitable, those sources go away. I'm old enough to have been a good searcher of NewsNet, a company that no longer exists and was a wonderful source of newsletter information. Gone. In a perfect world, searchers are always satisfied with how the sources work, with how the searching goes. And so what we want in an ideal best case scenario is for searching and finding to come together. And in that instance, the role of the librarian becomes this: the ultimate search engine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Dee. We'll be allowing plenty of time for questions and answers at the end of the whole panel. Right now, to distract you from this moment, I'll read one more quote that I came across that I felt was shocking in its profundity, from a guy that wasn't noted for that kind of thing, Dan Quayle.
Once said, "Hey, from Indiana, you watch it."
I watched it.
Shocking for you. How could you not watch it?
Dan Quayle once said, "The future will be a better tomorrow." Okay, our next panelist is Jay DeTima. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I've been following your day team all time. You never corrected me.
Jay Dadima is the technology editor of Library Journal, assuming responsibility for the magazine's quarterly technology supplement, NetConnect, as well as LJ's technology features and columns, numerous, including online databases and digital libraries. He oversees the LJ Tech blog, in addition to all that other work. Jay received his MLIS from Dominican University, River Forest, Illinois, in 1998, and his MBA from Binghamton University, upstate New York. He's also served as a reference librarian and coordinator of public access computing at Cornell University's Mann Library in Ithaca, before moving on to Ovid Technologies. Most recently, Dadima founded Bookism, a consulting service to scientific and research libraries. Jay Dadima.
Thanks very much. So glad to join the other illustrious panelists here. Ron invited us to give a similar presentation in Charleston last November, so I called this one More Searching, or More Finding, Less Searching Redux, because there's been some changes since then. So what is the future of search? The future of search, oddly enough, is the past. More information is available, going back further than ever before. More and more search is authenticated. Even though there's a lot that's freely available, there's more emphasis on authenticating who the user is. It's also distributed and networked. There's not so much local searching from CD-ROMs or other things, of course. Future of search, when things are being captured, is also private. I think we'll see more and more of that. And then finally, I think the future of search is mobile. This is the first conference where it's been really nice not to carry around a laptop. For those of us that have phones, they're turning into kind of all-purpose devices, and some of us may be camping out on Friday for the iPhone, who knows. But in Roy Tennant's phrase, the future of search, with book information coming online, mass digitization means mass responsibilities. And I think As we see things being locked up more and more, especially as books are scanned, I think that all of us as librarians have a responsibility to ensure that people have the same freedom to read that they've always had. And people, as they thought about the future of the book in particular, have kind of had these same concerns all the way back. And so I have five different authors that I've enjoyed reading over the years, and I have some quotes from each of them. In Balzac's Lost Illusions, probably my favorite one out of his human comedy, he talks about what happened with the widespread distribution of the printing press. And as you can see from this first quote, it's the first paragraph of the novel. What it had the biggest impact on was localities. So people could actually control the information about their town and disperse it widely. But as time has gone along, people have tried to control that information. So in the era of the printing press, there was kind of a more universal access to information. Ernst Jünger, who served in the German army and was pretty prescient, I think, about how restrictions to information worked, in this novel, The Glass Bees, which has been reissued, and I think it's a great book, he talks about a company that seems very much like one maybe in Mountain View. And talking about the hardest thing there is how to control what people think. The smarter they are, the harder it is. And in this case, if someone's ambitious enough to force dead matter to think, he cannot do without original minds. And it talks about the skill of highly trained experts. Okay. So here's a quote that's a little bit more worrying, perhaps. And this is from 1984. It's a French critical theorist. And Lyotard says, in the next century, there won't be any books. It takes too long to read when success comes from gaining time. And he goes on to talk about what may happen, and I think is happening now. And the book will be distributed at a premium, yielding a financial profit for the publisher and a symbolic one for the reader. So these three authors that I just used, I mean, they kind of predate the kind of controversies most of us have seen in the library world. Sven Burpertz, who wrote the Gutenberg Elegies in 1995, really had something that seemed alarmist at the time. But as I think about what he was saying in this essay in particular, and in some of the others in the book, what he's saying is our biggest commodity in the age of information overflow, like Mary Dee said, is sustained time to read. And so as things flip by on the screen and other things, I think our responsibility is, after you've searched for something, how do you ensure that you're turning it into a form that you can understand, and also that your end users have some way of being able to make sense of. And I think that that's a big challenge. And finally, of course, our friend Nicholson Baker. I found it interesting looking in Google Book Search that his books are there, but there's no preview available. So perhaps it's the new microfilm after all. So the future of search, there's a lot of exciting things about it, and I guess I'm not talking about those so much today as providing some cautionary things. Search has been commoditized. So I remember the days in library school 10 years ago where, like in Mary Dee's example, you had very elegant search strategies because it cost you money with connect time and other things. But now I think when you think that a search is free, perhaps the actual cost is the cost of privacy. And as well as the freedom to read, I think protecting privacy is maybe in the top three things that librarians might want to think about. And search certainly has been monetized. People are making money off of it. There's no doubt about that. But there are some good things about the way that it's been commoditized, and I think that search syndication, you can embed searches that you've done that are very complicated, and you know, friends that are looking for apartments on Craigslist can embed RSS feeds into web pages and very quickly see if there's something that's available. Google News gives you the same sort of alerting information. Sometimes you find out more about the companies you work for from these news alerts than from your internal email. And then the first place I saw search syndication was this MyOAI, which Francois Chittacott had put together. It was searching over the first set of OAI repositories. And so I think that in an age of commodified search, there's a real advantage if you know what it is you're looking for. So less searching, more finding. I am kind of an avid user of the now Yahoo service Delicious. And I think Delicious is indeed delicious. And one of the nice things it does with the network is that if you have some people that you're following, you get to see what they're reading in a way that's quicker. And so you see the results of what they've searched for in a way that's probably quicker than anything else. And Lorcan Dempsey, the OCLC strategist, has been saying that we need to aggregate supply to increase demand. And so thinking about that in the context of Delicious and other things, trying to figure out what that means exactly. In the case of OCLC, does that mean that they're trying to enhance services for all libraries or just larger libraries? And does it mean a few central repositories or distributed things, kind of like what Balzac was talking about with the printing press? Or is it just an attempt for OCLC to enter the stage, you know, with Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and Amazon as the player, the company that represents libraries? I'm not quite sure. Some other kind of cautionary things. Herbert von Gesampel, who's contributed a lot of original research in OpenURL and now OAIORE, was showing off some recommender system research. And so one of his colleagues at Los Alamos had tracked the searches that people had done using SFX and other things. And so if you wanted to know what your colleague was doing, it was very easy to see this, and the recommender system research was quite incredible. And before anyone asked a question, he said, "I have no answers for any of the privacy issues." And if someone that brilliant hasn't been able to come up with some sort of elegant way, I think more and more our technical issues are vastly behind some of the social issues. And over time, I think librarians, we've had a way of being in the front line to try to answer some of those privacy concerns for our users. So, authentication. John Blyberg, who was at the Ann Arbor District Library and now is at the Darien Public Library, won a competition from Talos last year. And what he had done is he had extracted information from his catalog and turned it into a Google gadget so you could see the items you had checked out, the items you had on hold, and everything else. And I use Google pretty avidly, too, and it was I could see the immediate advantage there, but then you realize that you're turning over all of that information immediately to Google. So there's this sort of benefit and cost at the same time. So I think as we think about the future of search, the authentication systems that are in use are probably quite useful to become familiar with. Athens, which started in the UK and is kind of a single sign-on for all of the higher education institutions there, it's starting to be rolled out in the U.S., and medical libraries are starting to adopt it. I think it's a kind of an elegant solution. Shibboleth, which has been sitting around for quite a while now, is still gaining adopters at the edges. I see that Ovid has just added support for it. One of the nice things about Shibboleth, if you don't know, is that it tries to protect the privacy of the searcher, as well as not passing the information back to the information provider. And LDAP, always useful for librarians to understand how they can best exploit how LDAP works, both in their institutions and elsewhere, whether it's a local copy or being able to synchronize things to make it easier. And then the last thing is OpenID, which is starting to get some adoption in applications. There's a travel application I use, Doppler, and it's really nice to be able to sign in with an ID that I've created for many other services. And what it does is it assumes your URL is owned by you, and so you don't have to come up with new passwords for each service that you use. And the past. Looking in the back files, I mean, it's been kind of amazing living in New York, searching for my address, being able to see when the apartment that I lived in was first advertised, you know, getting to see the prices, $30 a month, which that'd be nice. And being able to see, when you do searches, being able to search advertisements and other things, I think we're in an era of hyper-available information, which is kind of a beautiful thing. Even magazines like Nature have complete runs back to the first volume. And I've been able to find a lot of things that I've been searching for without those previous cutoffs. 1980, which used to be a gray line. 1966 for Medline, and then 1950. But I think more and more expectations are that things are moving backwards. And, of course, the elephant in the room is adding not just newspaper information, but book information. So 10 million new volumes this month. And what has been provided, and they're still up there, is kind of an amazing lack of quality control in this Google project. And when they're asked about it, they say, well, that's where the cost is. And I think, well, that's where the cost to libraries is in 10 years, because if these are the copies that we're getting back, and there's examples of missed pages and fingers and everything else that comes in digitization projects, I think we're missing something. And they're copies that are really only good for interlibrary loan. Maybe. So what can we do? Personal digital libraries, I think, are a good option. One of the things, Zotero, which is a Mellon-funded project, it has a feature that enables you to save what you're looking at on the page. Lox, which is an archive project, lets you do that too. And one of the nice things here about Zotero is you get an integrated view of your citations. And so what you're looking at, you can capture for yourself. You'll be able to store a copy of online. And it also assumes the web is a full partner in your research. And so there's not really a split between print sources and web sources. And you can find it at zotero.org. And there's also, you know, many search options. Of course, Microsoft. Ask is doing some interesting things. They've had some natural language processing research that's coming in nice, interesting ways, especially with Gary Price there trying to make it useful for reference. Another search engine I've been tracking is PowerSet, which is still in beta, but it seems to be doing some nice ontology work. And then there's more and more search work that's done around local and maps. There's a service, Stephen Johnson, who wrote a book, Interface Culture, that I like a lot, has been working on the service with others called Outside.in. And so when you provide a zip code to it, it tries to aggregate all the information that's very local about a neighborhood. And so it does some of those kind of human things to gather that information for you. And there's always interesting things with visualization. Grokker, which has been around for a long time as a client application, I think with the web application has not only pretty pictures for you all to look at, but it's not a bad federated search tool. There's some SUNY libraries in upstate New York that have adopted it for use where it searches their catalog, Google, as well as licensed databases. And it uses SRU, SRW to do a live holdings lookup, which I think is a kind of nice mix of things, especially for instruction. Also, when you think about search and when you think about how it's been commoditized, what's the upside for librarians and users and developers? And often it's a search API. So an API is just a way of being able to query something kind of automatically, like in that Craigslist example from before. APIs build users. So maybe what we should be asking our library vendors for are more open APIs, more common APIs. And looking just at the example of PubMed, it spawned all kinds of interesting applications in the medical world. PubMed is a really nice interface. It uses the underlying data store. But the danger with APIs is that they need to be updated, simple, and not monetized in a way that prevents use. OCLC has a new service, XISBN. It just came out of beta. But as soon as you use it more than 500 times per day, the rates are kind of high. So I think that as we think about asking for APIs, we also want to be able to do it in such a way that it's not like something like interlibrary loan, where we're worried that we can't provide the level of service. One API that I've been tracking and it's very easy to experiment with yourself is OpenSearch. What it does is it syndicates searches as RSS, so it's a kind of a simple API to layer on top of things, and it's a nice way to turn a database into a workflow application. So just a few final cautionary things. I think what we're finding in the vendor space is that lock-in doesn't work. With the private equity ownership of a couple of the ILS vendors, I think what you have to realize is that more or less the companies are being held by others that are making decisions about not only marketing budgets, but about what the path of the future is in integration. And often what private equity owners are looking for is double-digit returns and around 5 years of ownership. So you have to keep that uppermost in your mind. If you're developing training guides or other things like that, be aware it's kind of like if you owned your house and then you turned into a rental. You may stay, you may not. So I've given kind of a wide-ranging sort of thing. There are some amazing benefits, I think, to the book digitization and unbounded text. I was at a Google presentation a couple days ago, and Ben Bunnell was saying that they've digitized a million of the perhaps 55 million books that are in existence. So there's a long way to go yet. But one of the nice things will be faster interlibrary loan. I think CIC, the consortium with the Big Ten libraries and the University of Chicago, it'll be a really nice thing for them to offer almost instantaneous interlibrary loan with the books that they've digitized. And print on demand, I think, is another interesting outcome of having books digitized. I think Michael probably has some things to say about that. But the New York Public Library on Thursday has just installed this machine, the Espresso machine, and it's like the size of three photocopiers, and it's 800 pounds. And what it lets people do is come in and find the books that they want and print out a perfect bound paperback in 4 minutes. And so, you know, that has some interesting and perhaps positive implications. And the other thing is, beyond all the cautionary sort of things, with mass digitization, we've been through this already with e-journals, and we're 15 years into that. The other thing, in thinking about private equity ownership and the sort of commoditization is, libraries have always licensed items to users. So we've been comfortable with the licensing metaphor. But more and more, I think that expertise is needed not only on the technical side, but also in the licensing realm. So with contracts, I don't think that the lawyers are going to retire anytime soon. I don't know if libraries need more collective bargaining. One interesting thing on the horizon with that is a standard from NISO. It's the Shared Electronic Resources Understanding. So for 80% of publishers that don't employ a lawyer on staff and they don't want to go through the 6 months or a year of negotiation, people are sending terms of use instead. So the University of Chicago Press and some other places. And I think that holds some promise. And also, you know, when libraries bought books, print books, they didn't sign a license for them. So I don't think we should move toward more restrictive terms. Okay. So the last slide is practical steps. Thinking about guarding your data with your life. If there's a way to keep local copies and redundant copies, that's always a good thing. Adding contract clauses for collective bargaining is also useful. And then something called BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Even after you've signed an agreement that might be restrictive, it's always useful to go back to the person that you signed it with and try to negotiate different ways around that, if you can. I don't think you should look at things as final. And then I guess I'd end with Nicholson Baker. What we want to avoid is microfilm all over again. Thanks.
Once again, that was Jay Dabima. And our first speaker, in case you've just walked in late, was Mary D. Ojala. And let me remind you that we will have plenty of time for Q&A after this. And I also, I guess I should apologize for the lack of seating space here. Thank you for putting up with this. There's still a few inches of floor space for those of you that are willing and able to do things like sit on the floor. That's also a possibility. Our next panelist has the rare distinction of being the first technology evangelist that I've had the pleasure to meet. Mike Bushman, and I understand there may be some changes in this, but I'm going to give you the bio that I have. You don't always go to a presentation with the bio that you want.
Things on the bio that we know, the bio we don't know.
Right. Mike Bushman is the program manager for Microsoft's Windows Live Academic. Mike received his MLIS from the Information School at the University of Washington. In addition, Mike has taught courses at the Web Technology Essentials Certification Program at the University of Washington. Mike Bushman.
Thanks so much, Ron. Yes, there actually are librarians at Microsoft. I'm here as proof. Just to update my bio, I am a technology evangelist, and besides the academic search we put out, I also evangelize for the book search that just came out, and that's what I want to talk about in depth, kind of following up on what Jay was saying. In general, I'd like to kind of dive in detail, talk about what we are doing, what we will be doing, and sort of the implications of that. Windows Live is a bunch of services that Microsoft has, you know, Windows Live Hotmail, Virtual Earth, all sorts of other projects like that. And Live Search is a part of that. And the team that I belong to under Search is a part of Live Search. So we're trying to unlock some of the information that's not already on the web. Just to give you an idea about some of the things that are on Live Search that are coming up that you may or may not be aware of. This is a local search, including a search of the place we're at right now. This is the conference center on the right. In a lot of large cities around the world, we're actually taking planes and flying over cities and taking pictures. So besides getting the maps and the satellite imagery, you get this offset picture of buildings and such, so you can point them out. Academic launched last year. In fact, one of the first places we talked about it openly was at ALA at New Orleans last year. It's an association. Most of the metadata and full text comes from places like Crossref and Highwire. If you're not familiar with them, they're very publisher consortium, group-hosted sites. Right now, we've built it up. There are 40 million or so articles, conference proceedings, book metadata, and it's represented in over 30,000 journals. So as I was saying, the group that formed UnderSearch almost 2 years ago is there to sort of unlock this shadow world of offline information. And there is sort of this perception, you know, if it's not on the web, it doesn't exist. If, you know, a back file goes back to 1966, and what you wanted was in that journal in 1960, it, you know, just is not there. But the reality is, you know, it's the consensus is about 5% of the world's information is online. So that's a lot, that's a big chunk that isn't. And here's something I don't know if you all saw this a couple months ago. The New York Times had an article called History Digitized and Abridged. And they had this chart in here. This is the National Archive. And if you can see that the huge partial bubble there are the texts that are in the National Archive, and the little dark bubble is what's been digitized so far. And as we go down, talking about aerial photographs, still pictures, etc., as the dark little bubbles are only what's been digitized. So they have a long way to go. So I'm going to dive into what we've been doing on the book search side. There's two programs. One is a library program, and we work with the University of California, the University of Toronto, Cornell, New York Public, and the British Library. We also, 3 weeks ago at Book Expo America, unveiled the in copyright books that we had gotten from publishers as well. And a little plug, we're at booth 4000, so if you want to come down and see it in detail, I'm going to talk about other things here, but if you want to talk about more about the service, we can do that on the exhibit hall. I'll just briefly run through this. This is a picture of book search. You do a search on digital photography, you get the results on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, you can see the book that you're mousing over on the left. The thing that's circled is what we call a hit map. You can see the green... the green rows are where your search terms are in the book. When you click on a book, you can easily get to the table of contents. In a lot of cases, that's getting we're doing that better. You can see where you can buy the book if it's something that interests you, and also if it's controlled, we on the upper right, you can see how many pages you have left in viewing. Publishers will restrict viewing to 20%, 10%, something like that. We'll let you know how much you have left. And as you can see, the hit map on the right also lets you see what parts to focus on. We can also change the view, so and the upper red circle lets you change from seeing a lot of part of the page to the complete page, and sometimes that's nice. And the bottom one lets you see full page view like that. So let's talk about the library program a little more in depth. So it's basically three partners in this. So Microsoft, we've been in software for a while. That's where we come in. Libraries have the collections, right? But there's also scanning partners because getting good scans is very important to us, and working with it, as Jay said, it's a problem. We don't want to have to do this again in 10 years or feel like we should have done this better the first time. And with the libraries get scans back that we scan. You know, the libraries, this is their commitment to make the collections accessible. We get our libraries together twice a year to talk, including about what we should digitize next, how they work together, best practices. It's nice. And then one of the things that isn't as well known as or isn't talked about as much is these big collections where libraries have millions of books in their. They're not really getting circulated, but they still have to be maintained. They're in these huge warehouses. This gives them a return on investment that, you know, these books are actually getting used, and it makes sense for them to, you know, say to their stakeholders, see, it's really worth, you know, you putting this money into maintaining these collections over all these years. So, as you can imagine, it isn't just the scanning of the book. There's so much more into it, right? You have to get the books off the shelf. It has to fit in with the workflow. You can't come in there and just do things. This is how you have to do it and make the library change their workflow about how they circulate books, how they get books on and off the shelf. But also, we want to make it as efficient as possible, and to get as many books through the system, you know, the idea is to make this as seamless as possible. And then how do you handle exceptions? Because, you know, a lot of books are different. There are books that are very old and brittle. There are books where the texts go down into the gutter. There are, you know, really big books, really little books. So there's all sorts of exceptions you want to handle at first so that the pipeline works. And then as we go back afterwards, we'll do the exceptions. And then we work with a digitization plan at each library. I'll pass through there. Now I want to talk about kind of some fun under the hood. This is a slide that was created from the University of Toronto back in January, and the blue pie is are the books that are scanned. Now these books have, you know, they tried to eliminate the big ones and the stuff they can see on the shelf that isn't gonna work very well getting scanned. But still, there's still 8% of the books that went through that for one reason or another. Had to be, you know, set aside. So, like I said, they were too stiff, were afraid we were going to hurt the book, or, you know, the print is in the gutter. And they're also uncut pages. These are a lot of old books, and some of them have never been read, and what do you do about those, right? Here's a picture I took back in January. This is Scanner's Alley at the University of Toronto. And give you an idea, Toronto and California are members of the Open Content Alliance, so the Internet Archive is the scanning partner for that. And the model that the Internet Archive uses are 10 scanners. Actually, Toronto has 13. But people actually sit and turn the pages, and two cameras take pictures of each page at a time. It takes about 6 seconds to turn it over. A glass comes down and holds the pages in place. And there are two shifts of people here, so they work for about 7 hours, and then another shift comes in. They're doing about 1,000 books a week. So here's just some kind of fun facts so far. We've been doing this almost a year. The oldest book we've done right now is from 1475. I don't know why, how, you know, it's they let us do that one. That's great. Book with the most pages. We did a book with over 1,800 pages, this Dictionary of Medicine. I think that was an experiment that worked, but you know, as you can imagine, it's this thick. It's a lot harder when you have a, you know, the thing. And then the most ironic title, of course, these guys are looking at them all the time, and you know, they have to crack themselves up. So there's this book from the 19th century called The Life of Mohammed by George Bush. Don't think it was that, George. And the most interesting thing they found in a book so far, and so this isn't how it was scanned, Jay, by the way, is this is a long braid. I don't know if people can see this in a poetry book. So future directions. This is future directions for what we'll be doing. You know, we have, you can search on books from live. It's books.live.com, or if you do a search, there's a tab that says books, right? But you have to cognitively say, hey, maybe I want a book, and go over there. As we go forward, it makes more sense to put relevant books in when people are searching for web, because they're not really searching for web. They're searching for information. They're searching for answers. And if there are better answers in the book, you know, we should get it to them at that point. We've got some innovative things coming around the actual experience once you're within the book. Unlocking non-textual information. So there's, you know, what happens when we have all the music instruction books, right? So you've got, you know, how can you unlock, you know, search for music in that way? I mean, right now, if you have the music instruction book, the only way you're going to be able to search it is on the lyrics, right? But there's a lot of other information in there. There's data. How about math books? You know, it's really hard to search on math equations, that kind of thing. That's in there. We'll be doing more partner summits and shared learning, of course. So some of the implications we've found already, you know, increased efficiency in research. So I was talking to some Cornell librarians, and they were telling me a story of a researcher who was doing Jane Austen research and wanted to research how her books dealt with table manners. And it's research that, you know, he could have done before, but it's really easy for him to go in and take all her books and search for table, you know, fork and napkin and those kind of things. And he could do the research in way less time. The new research connections, I think this is one of those things that is really exciting, because there are things that are going to come out of having all these books online we just can't anticipate. New York Public put online all their menus, historical menus in New York. And, you know, you think, that's great, okay. But a researcher from Seattle was doing research on depleted fish stocks and used those menus as part of his research to see what the restaurants were serving fish-wise and not over time. So, you know, you just don't know what you're going to get when these things are available. And, of course, enhanced text, right? You know, you can think of, you know, hyperlinking table of contents, hyperlinking out to you know, other places of information, connecting books, and then text liberating from form, of course, so slicing and dicing these books. So this is my last thing. I certainly don't have the answers to these, but something to think about, and that we're going to have to think about. So what is the atomic unit of a book now when it's all online? I mean, sometimes you want to look for a book, but really you may want, you know, the chapter might be the smallest. How about a paragraph? I mean, it really, you know, a line of poetry. You know, it's going to change the way things are, you know, and how do we identify those? You know, it's easy to have an ISBN for a book. Are we going to have, you know, a DOI or an ISBN for a paragraph? So what is a work, right? So if you want Tom Sawyer, you know, when there's movies and poetry and everything else, you know, how are you going to differentiate and do that? Is Wicked the same thing as The Wizard of Oz, and how related are they? The future of the physical library. You know, when these collections are there and everybody is sharing 55 million, you know, books, should everybody still be collecting all the books? I think there's good reasons, pro and con there. And as this industry develops, what part are we going to play? You know, how's that going to change what we do? So, like I said, I don't have the answers on that. But it's definitely something we're going to have to think about. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Mike Bushman. And Jay Dedema and Mary D. Ojala will be available. I've left a lot of time in the room after we finish up for a good Q&A session. You know, when I see something like research on depleted fish stocks drawing on a database of New York restaurant menus, it really makes me feel that the future is, in fact, not at all intimidating and frightening the way some of us feel, but quite reassuring that there are going to always be places and a need and demand for trained and skilled information professionals, and these tools are going to make it even more important for people to be really skilled information professionals. Now, the next speaker and our last speaker, and then we're going to turn it over to you folks for question and answer, is R. David Lankus. Dr. Lankus is the director of Information Institute of Syracuse and an associate professor at Syracuse University School of Information Studies. His past research projects include the Gateway to Educational Materials, GEM, the Virtual Reference Desk, VRD. There's one thing that our times can be noted for, I think it's the proliferation of acronyms. And the Educator's Reference Desk, David Lankus.
Thank you. We go from Microsoft Live Search Academic to a live academic. And so, you know, some of you may have heard me, and when I'm in bigger rooms, I get my Baptist preacher going on, and then you realize you get here in smaller settings, and I'm much more boring. Because I live my other life is as a true hardcore geek. So could I just get a sense of the room? How many people sort of identify yourselves as the hardcore geek? Okay, so the rest of you will have fun for the next 10 minutes. No. I should also say that I have no idea what I'm talking about, and we can move forward, but I have very smart doctoral students who give me Greek letters to put behind some of this stuff. I want to start in a weird way. I want to start about talking about a failure of an experiment that just didn't work out, and it's called Reference Extract. It began its life as Bibliomancer. And the idea was, it was an interesting idea. I had a big argument with my former advisor, Mike Eisenberg, and he said, what if librarians did Google? And, you know, wouldn't it be highly credible and all this other stuff? And I was coming back going, what makes librarians special? Why does a librarian have an ability to find better information than anyone else in the world? We were talking about credibility at the time. He didn't like this, and I'm sure you don't like where this is going. But he said, you know, no, they're librarians. They know how to find good information. I said, absolutely not. I said, that's not what we train librarians. That's not what makes them special and dear to our hearts. What makes librarians special and dear to our hearts is they can find good information for you. That for you is an important part because what it means is context. And we're going to get back into that in a minute. Librarians are excellent at process, but part of our advantage is that we are relatively unbiased when we approach these questions. We worry about a user's context more than other things. So we said, if we build this search engine, how could we do it? Well, the first thing about going and cataloging the internet to get a nice little MARC record that we can do our wonderful searches through. Been there, didn't do that, don't want to go back there. So that's out. Right? But what could we do? Well, we were looking, you know, some of you may also know that I play in the reference world. We were looking at reference transcripts. We said, you know, we have 750,000 reference transcripts lying around where users ask questions, and we gave them answers, and we're going to assume that librarians are good at finding information for you. There should be some value in this. We're also worried about privacy, which is we don't want to just take our reference transactions and put them online for the world to see. So we said, how can we sort of, in a very simple but highly effective way, utilize and mine this information?
And so what you see here is a quick workflow where we took the full text of these questions, we ran them through a nice little Perl script where we stripped out all the URLs. So what we did is we said we just grabbed all the URLs out of these reference transactions, all that personal data about why they wanted to know how to remove this type of wart and where it was located, gone. And we took those URLs and we put them into a nice little spidering system, originally something called Spider, which was a very slow PHP system, but then Nudge, which is, anyway, geek stuff, sorry, that would go and do full text searching and page ranking and all that wonderful stuff. At the same time, what we began to do was calculate frequencies. How often was this site referred to or referenced? And the idea was that we were developing, well, I'll show you right here. We came up with these counts. So this is, I believe, Ask Eric, a service we created called Ask Eric, and we looked at how many times these URLs along the bottom were referenced. And we said, oh, this is interesting. And as the sort of sample moved, this is another system. I believe this is called, this is Ask NSDL. This is one on Kids Connect and a few other services. But what's really interesting about these graphs, and I don't play a statistician, but I know really good ones, is that they begin to approach something called a ZIF diagram or a ZIF distribution or a power curve. And this is really cool because now what you can think of is boosting results. So now you go into our little reference extract and you put in a retrieval set and you put in whales and up pops the retrieval set. But now we can say, but this one, this resource at number 8 is the number one resource cited on whales. Let's bump it up to the top, right? And so now what we're doing is we're coming up with reference weighting. We're the idea of bouncing questions up to the top, and we made really pretty pictures that I was very proud of, which is weighting. And this is, we thought of this as equivalent to PageRank, right? Where the thing that's most linked to gets bumped up. Well, this is the most things most cited. And we said you can't just take it. So at the top you have something called Ask NSDL, which was a science community, and you can see that the citation pattern is nuts, right? What those colors are is each color is a site, is a URL, and the width of that color is how many times it was cited, and then you're looking over time. All right, so it's crazy. In other words, these, you know, they're coming, they're going. At the bottom you see Ask Eric. Now what's interesting about Ask Eric is if you see that nice little sort of brown sage sand color, this is why they don't pick me to name paints on cars. That's a site called edrs.org. And if you're familiar at all with Eric, that was the document reproduction service. So people would ask us about a document, we'd send them there. The bottom one is actually edrs.com. And what happens is, can you tell when they merge the two websites, right? So it's nice and coherent and beautiful, and so we can take this nice long window to bounce results. Now, I said it's a failed experiment. Why is it a failed experiment? Well, number one, the URLs at the sort of left end that we get really interesting. Have you ever had the wonderful position of asking a graduate student to go look for pornography in your search engine? That it's a fun time, right? Closing the door, yeah, I really know. Don't show the blog to anyone else. You know? But the idea is, because what happens, you get URL, people buy URLs, and so the, you know, autismforkids.com suddenly becomes something not for kids and nothing about autism. But, so it didn't work. But the real thing it didn't work for was we discovered the dangers of contextless search. Now, I'm going to call these Maiwa's question paradox and McClure's citation strategy. Don't look for them. They don't exist. I'm making these terms up. Makiko Maiwa did a study of the Ask Eric questions and answering. She was looking at how people ask questions and how in the search process they do information problem solving, right? Big Six stuff, yay. And what she found is this paradox where people at the beginning of search and at the end of the search, we use exactly the same words and queries and mean radically different things. So the example is, if you're doing a doctoral dissertation and you're at the beginning of the process, you ask for a question like, tell me everything about X. Right? And what you're doing is you're looking for a big swamp that you can go wade through and learn something about. At the end, the very end, the day before you're about to defend the dissertation, you may well ask, tell me everything you know about X. And what you're looking for is exclusion. What did I miss? Who's going to cite something that's going to screw me up in my defense? Same words, different questions. McClure's citation strategy is, Chuck McClure once gave me wise advice, which he says, you know, with going for tenure, you need citations. He goes, there's three ways to be highly cited. Say it first, say it last, or say it's stupid. If you're first, you're the seminal document, right? If you're last, you're the summary document that everyone points to, and if you say stupid, at least they have to cite you when they tell you you're being an idiot. Right? And in the reference world, we're used to this because it's like if a reporter walks in and says, tell me really good resources on hate groups. You know, the Ku Klux Klan website is a great way. So if you're looking at transcript, it's KKK dot whatever it is. Citation. If you're an eighth grader looking for after-school programs, probably not the same URL you want to send people to. But since we just grabbed the URL, we have no idea about the context. And so we may be citing a lot of, don't ever go here, this is horrible, this is biased, this is whatever. So this wasn't going to work. What we did is, in January, we released a paper on participatory networking and participatory librarianship. We were looking for an underlying reason for this kind of disconnect. And what we looked at is a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask, cybernetician, anyway, from England in the 70s, came up with something called conversation theory. And he was looking at how people learned. And what he said was, knowledge is created through conversation. And search and find, we're using all these different words, but ultimately what we're dealing with is knowledge creation. People are going out and looking for things to enrich and inform their knowledge. That's done through conversation. That conversation can be one-on-one, it can be one-to-many, many-to-many. It can also be internally. People say, well, if I'm alone, can I have a conversation? Yes, you talk to yourself all the time. Sometimes I'm the only one who understands me in the room, as we're right now. And so it's called metacognition if you're all into instruction. So there's a conversation going on where we construct knowledge. Artifacts, books, web pages, all these things that we're spending lots of time scanning are merely byproducts. They're artifacts. They're not the knowledge. They're the output of a knowledge process. And ultimately, they're a very pale ember of knowledge. They can generate knowledge. They can start these things. They have utility. I don't want to say let's get rid of the books. I just want to acknowledge that a book is a convenient way of sharing knowledge. It's not necessarily the best way to share knowledge. So now in a digital world, we have this really interesting thing where we can actually track the conversation. And so how can we, instead of focusing on these items, I mean, I personally, in the search thing, we talk about the people, I think we've just about managed to wring about all the blood out of the stone called bibliographic data. Right? We can only describe this thing so many more times before we run out of, and this is what the font of the page number looks like, and that's right. And so where can we find this quantum leap to move from searchability to findability? I think it's in the utility, the use of these items, the context of these items. So we started by decomposing reference. We went back to these reference transcripts and we said, all right, we get a question. Question has an answer, or it goes through a series of processes. All right. Now, in a transcript, is the transcript a document, or are these individual utterances a document? This is the idea of how do we model these things. But what's interesting is we also know that for each one of these actions, there's a series of tags or information we can do. Who said it? When did they say it? How old is it? What is the actual text of the query? What's the language the query is in? All this wonderful stuff. And we also have this sequence data. We know that this happens in time. One of the things that I look at modern search engines, and someone said, well, you know, Google's won the search war. And I said, you ever win the search war? It's like Alexandria Library in Egypt won the search war, but they didn't get to keep the trophy. These search engines are beginning to drown in their own history. If you type, I want the latest of something, within now the top 10, precious top 10 results, the latest from 86, the latest from 84. I mean, they don't have a sense of time. We have that in these sorts of conversations. We know that there are lots of different transcripts and conversations, and what we can do by looking at these tags is we can begin to associate them, and this is a wonderful speech on self-organizing systems and complexity theory that even I get bored with. But what we can do by looking at this kind of rich data is we can come up with an interesting conversation or document model where we can look at how these things were connected. So instead of just saying this happened, then this happened, then this happened, we can say a lot of people asked a question about here. And most of the people who used these words liked this type of answer. And the URLs in these things were common, right? So what we're doing is we're reducing down. And if you look at this for a minute, and this is the heavy-duty geek stuff, this looks remarkably like a Bayesian prediction tree. In other words, one thing we found out is if you want the answer to a question, and you look at a transcript, it's rarely the last utterance, because that's almost always thank you. And it's rarely the last time you see the keyword, because the keywords are used more often in asking the question than they are giving the answer. So what you actually want to do is, if you find a node that has all these wonderful answers, you actually want to give them the next node. That's often how you predict the answer. The other thing that is that if you think of nodes, meaning those little utterances, those little questions, right, and you know the links between them, those are called edges in this thing called graph theory, and this is exactly the kind of model that's used in GPS. Now, excuse me while I go left field for just a moment, but it's really kind of a cool idea. Imagine if you could say, I want to know how this idea got to this idea. I want to know why the Washington, D.C. becoming the capital led to the idea of eliminating mosquitoes and typhoid in the United States, because we're in a swamp, and as you go outside today, you'll know you're in a swamp, right? Well, what you can do is you can actually look between the shortest path between that utterance and that utterance, even though there may be disparate conversations, and you can begin to navigate how information moved and how information grew, and you can find whole new ways of information relating. The interesting part, the context, is in the middle. The context is in the connections between these documents, not in the documents. We've all had a situation where someone's come in and asked for a book, and when you ask them why they're using the book, it just sort of goes, good Lord, I never thought about that, right? The idea of using New York menus to talk about fish populations is brilliant. You will never be able to search fish populations and pull up menus unless you capture the conversation, unless you capture that interim. Journal articles are clearly about connecting things, but we'll get to that in a minute. We're talking about the idea of using this now to, this is an e-reserve system that we're modeling for SU, where when you come in, instead of saying, here are your books, and here are your articles, and here are your these things, what we can say is, this is a conversation going on. This one happens to be out of class. We have a syllabus. A syllabus is a conversation. It's how someone looked at information and organized it. It's not a reading list. It says we're going to read this on this topic and read this on this topic, and there's a sequence to it. And we can map that to different documents. So now when someone begins to search for a document, maybe they find out that, you know, that book down there is actually used in three different classes. And one's in anthropology, and two are in computer science. There's an interesting connection. What is the connection between these ideas, and is this a new form of opportunity for scholarship? This is a system we're developing we call PASC, because we like Gordon. And what it is, it's the document. This is actually an excerpt of the paper we wrote on participatory networks, but you'll notice in the left and right-hand columns, you see incoming and outgoing links. How many people have been in a listserv discussion that has just gone out of control? Right? It's like, where should we eat on Friday night, you communist bastard? How do you know? We call those threads, but they're not threads. What happens is, and this is, you know, I mean this in the most delicate way, they forked. That you get this conversation and you have this split. Well, let's map that so that when in a wiki environment or whatever, we can actually see when these ideas diverged. One of the things I love about wikis is collaborative editing. One of the things I hate is it actually hides the history. It's there, but it's not obvious. What I want to know is when I link to a Wikipedia article, and I go there a week later, and I went to this nice little page that suddenly got hijacked or changed. I actually, when I go follow that link, I don't want to go to the new hijacked or changed. I want to go to the original one I linked. And I want to know that that linked one has been changed so I can follow it. That's a way of doing threads. That's not a document-centric view. So you end up by doing a search result and being able to see, well, what's previous to that result? So you find a book by Dave Lankus. What book did he write beforehand? What articles did he write beforehand? And what's next? This idea of next and previous, where it's not just next and previous on a hit list, but conceptually next and previous. And we know that that result is also used in another thread. So here's Dave talking about, you know, conversation in terms of search. By the way, he also talked about conversation in terms of reference, and here's how you can now follow that thread. And if there's another incoming context or another outgoing context, we can begin to get it. Now, what we're talking about is discovering conversational data. This isn't as radically Web 2.0 new. ISI has managed to make a very nice profit on figuring this out a while ago. But there's all sorts of conversational data that we now have the opportunity to take advantage of in our catalogs and in our databases and in our systems. So reference is an obvious example. Web 2.0 are participatory systems with blogs and wikis and collaborative bookmarks, right? Dig is I like Dig more than Delicious. because not only do you get the bookmark, but you get this conversation about this thing that was bookmarked and such. In-text citation, not just at the end. You don't want to just know that I pointed to someone. You want to know that I really, you know, reamed them before I pointed to them, right? Annotated bibliographies, reading lists, syllabi, things that we've lived in. And what we're ultimately talking about is moving to a wider document model. A book is a conversation. And that author, not only did they break it into chapters, they had to pick the order of that chapters, right? Because a book is ultimately a linear thing. A conversation is ultimately a linear thing with time. So now what happens is when I find that chapter, I want to be able to find the book it came from, and then I want to be able to find all the other books that that author did. And now I want a context around this. Don't just give me a thing, right? In conversation theory, they talk about different levels of how you become dependent on a system. Is it a learning system or not? Right? So when I put a thing in Google and I get this result back, and I don't, you know, you said, we talked about before the idea that we know it points to commerce and we know that it skews to, we don't know that. We guess it, but the truth is that Google or our friends at Microsoft could change that at any moment, right? And so we don't truly know what's in that. It's not a learning system, but if we can capture the conversations, we can begin to get at it. So my final comment, and then I'll sit down, is what do I see as the future of search? It's the conversation. That ultimately what we need to be doing as librarians, I take a bit of exception to the idea that the librarian is now the new search engine. To me, the librarian, and I know it is, but ultimately the goal of the librarian in this world is to facilitate conversations, right? It's to enrich them by providing them resources. It's to capture and archive them for memory and duration. It's to provide space for it to happen. It's to provide context and bring knowledge to bring people up to speed in a conversation. But all of that's trackable and searchable. It's community. One of the things is when people are talking about economic development in the Silicon Valley versus talking about Syracuse, New York, economic development is discussed, and trust me, they are radically different conversations. In Silicon Valley, it's like, oh boy, we got lots of traffic. And in Syracuse, it's like, please, God, if we only had traffic. Right? That's a community distinction, right? I mean, it's the same thing as saying, what is formula? Well, to a mathematician, it's a series of steps. To a chemist, it's a series of molecules. And to a mother, it's what you give to a baby to keep it from dying. Right? That's context, but that's a really absurd one that we can all agree to. But when you talk about the I-4 loop, or when you talk, the context behind that is we're talking about a highway, we're talking, right? That's community, is context. And what I ultimately think, and what I'm really, this is my Baptist preacher mode, we are in the right place to do this. Libraries are one of the few organizations that, yeah, we have books and resources that they want to scan, but that's not the value proposition we present. Right? The people are going to be able to get to millions and millions of volumes without us. What we want to be is this context provider, this facilitator, and building systems that take advantage of our community knowledge and our conversations so that ultimately the relevance is we are the best search engine, but it's because we're in the conversation business, not because we're in the Boolean business. Right? People aren't born speaking Boolean, you know. It doesn't happen. So my admonition to you is, while we're working on all this fun stuff, and while I can't wait to get at these books, and while I can't wait to get these resources, when they talk about the books coming alive and talking to each other, it's actually us talking about the books and keeping that conversation alive that is going to make a library a vital, important, interesting repository. And that's the value that we bring to this. It's not just go scan our books. It's, by the way, go ahead. What you're doing is you're taking a picture of, as Barbara Quint would say, the coral reef. Without the fish, right? We've got the life in this thing. And that's going to be more and more and more and more valuable, because if we keep trying to squeeze more and more out of metadata and table of contents and extant data in this resources, we're ultimately going to, Moore's Law ends. And it's like, all right, now we're going, it doesn't work. We need to know why these things are related, by whom that they're related, and given they're that related, what's next? Thank you very much for your time.
David Lankus, Mike Bushman, Jay Dedema, Mary D. Ojala. We're going to take all of your questions now. For any of these people, I'm sure that the only question you might have of me is, what are you doing up there? I'm Ron Miller. I'm the Director of Product Management at H.W. Wilson. There's a microphone in the center of the room. Feel free to approach it and line up and start asking questions. If there are any, perhaps you're so overwhelmed by the sheer brilliance of our panelists. I see a hand going up and ask the question. There's a mic right on the mic stand there.
Or just shout it out.
Yeah. Come on, go ahead. You have a question? Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, thank you. My question is, somewhat, I believe it was Jay, talked about the elephant in the room as being books and newspapers. I'd suggest we also have a sleeping rhinoceros in the room on this, who's going to be big trouble when and if he wakes. And that's the question of the degree to which data is going to be migratory or migratable through successive generations of technology. And I wonder if anyone on the panel would like to address that to enable some of us to sleep better so we don't worry about this rhinoceros quite so much. Thanks.
Anybody
want to
take it?
I don't know where this was published, but there's a great article from a researcher at the Rand Institute who says information lasts forever or 5 years, whichever comes first. And his point, he didn't use sleeping rhinoceros, but yeah, that basically is it, because we already know there's all kinds of data that we have the data. We do not have any way to play that data. You know, if your favorite music is on an 8-track tape, how many of us still have a working 8-track tape player? Remember when floppies were floppy? And somewhat larger? And yes, data is lost because of that. Let me say that it's not just the instrument upon which you play the data. The other issue, when Jay's comment about the future is past, I think that is really important because we are losing ancient documents because of natural disasters, because of man-made disasters, because of things burning, flooding, being blown up. And so we have digitization projects going on in various countries to try and preserve that. The issue in preservation is how long have you preserved it for? And we honestly believe today that we're preserving things that 10 years from now we may be in the same boat all over again, that yes, we preserved them, but we can't read them. And so you have to, when you do some sort of a digitization process, what you also have to factor in is redigitizing in another 5 to 10 years to accommodate whatever the newer technologies are. And that's a serious issue. Just ask NASA.
So I don't have any answers, but there's two things. I think everybody should take a look at LOX, which is a library project that came out of Stanford that's been around for a while now. And it stands for Lots of Copies, Keep Stuff Safe. Karen Schneider's writing an article about it. And what it does is it assumes that most libraries have a FreeBSD box, and it's making copies of what they've subscribed to as they view them on the screen. So if things go dark, at least there's that sort of distributed copy. And the second thing is, I don't know how this would work, but somehow harnessing the powers of the communities that your libraries serve to be able to try to keep digital or paper copies of the things that are most important to you.
I just like that. If you don't mind. Microsoft works a lot with the British Library on all sorts of projects, and one of the things, of course, the British Library is interested in is how do we keep this electronic data, you know, in the centuries time frame, which is not usually the way companies like Microsoft think. So there are some open document formats out there. One is a Microsoft format, one is an IBM format. But still, the answer is we don't know. And as Mary D said, as you transform these into the new technologies, I mean, not everything makes the trip, right? So there's things that get left behind in these other formats. So it's something people are thinking about. Digital's going to be around for a while, but you know, really the answer is, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, we'll have to see.
Well, I'm not touching that.
Okay, those that are on the center aisle, feel free to use the microphone. If you're on the outside aisle, just stand up and shout.
My question is for Ms. Ojala. When you said in your talk, automation makes the process longer, I was wondering whether it was because the process is more difficult or because expectations are so much higher from our patrons, for instance.
Well, I think it's both of those. Actually, I don't think the expectations are really that much higher. I think the expectations were always very high. Whether or not we actually lived up to those expectations is another question. But interestingly, what I really was talking about was it takes longer because there are more places to look. It's not that the looking is more complex necessarily, but let me give you a physical analogy. I worked in a corporate library, and in corporate libraries, space was really important because you paid rent, and so you were sort of one emblem of how valuable you were was how much space you had because the company was spending money on you. So they valued your services. Not so true anymore, but at one point, we were given the budget to expand the library physically. And what we found out was it took us longer to do things because if we were using the physical books, it literally took us longer to walk down the aisle to get to the book that used to be right here. And it's an analogy to what we're finding in the virtual world. It used to be when the online world started 30 years ago, you know, we had dialogue and we had LexisNexis. We didn't have anything else. So if you were going to do an online search, it was real simple. You had 5 databases on Dialog, and that was where you went. Today, we have millions of things that we could possibly be looking at. And so our mindset of how we go about looking through the information structure, where we go, has broadened out to such a degree that it takes us longer to get the answer, and we get multiple answers, which we have to sort through and say, well, which is the real one? Which is what our patron really needs in the context of what that patron wants, as David pointed out.
Another question? Or just the changes? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, my first I have a comment, then a question. My first comment is for, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, last speaker.
David Lankus.
David Lankus.
Dr. Lankus.
Dr. Lankus. Your speech reminded me a lot about a book I read a few years ago. I think the author was Jonathan Rosen, but I could be wrong, called The Talmud and the Internet, about, and this was way before all this Web 2.0 BS, all about how the Internet is a lot like this ancient compendium of knowledge called the Talmud, where rabbis across time and across space would have these conversations and form communities over time and space. And I thought it was a very interesting book examining how the internet really works and how it really affects us and how we really look for information. That leads me to a question for Mr. Bushman, was it? Since this ancient compendium of knowledge is not in Latin characters, I'm wondering if Microsoft is focusing solely on English Latin character-based text, or if there is any prospect of non-Roman texts?
The answer is yes. When we talk about 55 million books being online, that includes the entire process. And how we get there is in waves, and right now we're on an English wave. Like every other language will be covered over time.
Which is probably why only 5% of the world.
And that probably has a lot to do with that too.
Well, when you bring up the Talmud, I mean, actually, it was a slide I used at an acidic presentation was the Babylonian Talmud. Because it's not only is it in Hebrew, but those commentaries quite literally spiral around the citation. So it's not even in a nice little, oh, clearly that's a linear book. I mean, it's a brilliant example, by the way. It's one we use often. Thank you.
I found this all very interesting and stimulating, but I think that one of the 800-pound gorilla that's not in the room is many of our customers. I'm the director of a library system in the Los Angeles area, and we had some conversations recently about the decline in reference requests, and that good enough is good enough for most of our customers, and the sophistication that you describe is, while if it were instantly available and easily available to them, that it might be that is the case of good enough being good enough for them. But the investment in getting there is interesting, and it would be interesting to see how that actually develops in response to the decline of requests for information from us as information professionals. So in terms of it taking longer, taking longer is not good when time is the essential currency.
I think that depends on context. I come out of a corporate library background. And in the corporate world, frequently good enough is not going to cut it because it is going to come back and bite you. If you get it wrong, there are serious implications. What we do see, I think, in the corporate world, definitely, probably in some of the other environments in which information professionals work, what we see is the simple questions that we used to get asked. No, that's one of the reasons why there's a decline in reference statistics. Because yes, people can look it up for themselves, and probably should be looking it up for themselves, and perhaps always should have been. But now we've given them those opportunities. We've done the easy work. The hard stuff is what now comes to the information professional. And because it's harder, it takes more time because the question is more complex given the context in which the person is asking the question. That's why it takes longer. For the simple question, no, you're absolutely right. Time is not the issue. It's the quality of the answer. And if an individual can find a good answer that they're happy with in a short amount of time, fine. But if it's something that's really going to matter, then it needs to go to somebody who really will search everywhere to find the right thing.
I think the other thing with that is librarians have always saved time and money. And Google's been running around the publishers trying to sign up them for this kind of library account, which they're calling a way to sign in and be able to save and print and email the content that's in Google Books, and that concerns me somewhat. But there are two things that are, you know, fixed, time and money, and I think librarians have a role to play there, always.
Thank you for a stimulating presentation. I'm an art librarian, and I spend a lot of time, as do my users, trying to retrieve images. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about the present or future of image retrieval. In particular, even retrieval of images that are in books, because that's most of what I wind up helping my users find. In that particular stone, I think we haven't really squeezed any blood out of yet.
Absolutely right.
I can't tell from bibliographic information what images are in a book, and that's vital information for the study of visual culture, and it really promises, has a great deal of promise for research in visual culture across a number of disciplines.
You're absolutely
right. You guys know more about what's going on.
You're absolutely right. In fact, you'll know a lot more about this, but when you look at the web-based image retrieval system, they're actually based on the text that's around the image, right? And to me, that's conversational data. And what's also very interesting is when you look at attempts to reify terminology, in essence, the art and architecture thesaurus done 500 times, you find this distinct difference between terminology used by the artist community, by the critical community, for example. So there's even that disconnect. And to me, the answer comes back to, once you found it, right, you know why you found it, you know the context of the question, so that we should be able to capture that data so the next person who goes to find it should have that as well. I mean, certainly there's work in image retrieval with a query by example. There's work in the idea of identifying different, but it's so subjective right now that we just haven't focused our attention on images. You're absolutely right. It's a black hole.
I think right now it's even worse than that, because we don't even get the textual information about the images. Like, yeah. I can't search
right.
the citations.
There's three things I think that are a little hopeful about that. One is a project Steve.museum, which it's a collaborative tagging thing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the University of Toronto, and some of the data is going to both Princeton and the University of Michigan. And you can actually download the application. It has a way to tag images, and that's for things maybe not in books. For books, I'm hearing that the library partners are getting the images back as JPEG 2000, which is a nice lossless format. I think that our librarians and everybody else should take a look at JPEG 2000. And then the third is CSA, with their platform, has a new way of trying to attach caption data to images so you can search them. So I think that that's a hopeful move in the database industry, too.
One of the things
Unfortunately, the product is called Illustrata, and it's only, at the moment, it's only for the natural sciences, because
That's the CSA product.
That's the CSA product, and remember that it's now called ProQuest. So if you want to go look at it, it's at the ProQuest booth down there.
Also, I mean, like you said, it's like what information around a picture are you looking for? I mean, sometimes people are looking at images like another image, so you want some recognition stuff. One of the things, if people aren't familiar with the site Flickr and there are other ones like it, I mean, they have so many images there that are getting tagged so many times that it actually matters. They've actually reached the effect of, you know, people are putting 4 and 5 tags with a picture. It really gets into, it's almost even better than the caption. It's actually capturing what you're saying about, this is what I think it's about. I have this picture, and it's Nancy at the beach on, you know, on Labor Day weekend, and it's, you know, at a certain beach. So people can slice and dice that, and the aggregate really is powerful.
I'm not a Luddite, I promise. Tagging drives me nuts. We've realized a lot. Well, you know, not that I'm against folksonomy and tagging, but it's very easy to look at. My problem with tagging is it's not context enough. I mean, it is context, and it's useful to find keywords. But the idea that it would be like doing a reading list where you just listed a bunch of books and handed out. A year later, could you figure out why you put those books together? So with tagging, what tagging is really good at is discovery. It's really good at situational description. What it lacks is time. And so what would be really interesting is to look at tags used on multiple photos from sort of the same role. So I think tagging is useful, but ultimately one of the things that we're finding is tagging is not necessarily the solution. When we look at catalogs, people like Ann Arbor Public Library let you come in and tag books. Great. Whose tags? Why tag? What does that tag have to do with this tag? What we really want to get at is the idea that this image was used in this context for this problem, and tagging is a glimmer. It's I think a step in the right direction. But we really need systems. I'm more interested in Flickr, where you can go and drag them on the map, and you can geocode your images, because that's a real interesting context. So.
Although the either or is too simple, and I think that. The Library Journal, we published an interview with Tim Spaulding, the library thing founder,
yeah.
And Melissa Rethelson kind of got some of his special sauce out. And the thing that I thought was interesting is, as a supplementary data and looking at library thing for libraries, where you see tags applied to catalog records, what he's saying is the least interesting statistical tags, the personal ones, you can make those drop out. So it's additional information, it's contextual information. And so tags in and of themselves aren't necessarily fascinating, but they can be used to enhance both images and other bits of information.
I have to preface my comments by saying, please don't stone me as a heretic. I was fascinated with what David was talking about in terms of conversation and how you're trying to get contextually what it is you're after. 10 years ago, Encyclopedia Britannica, World Book, Americana, never anticipated Wikipedia. It was just beyond their scope of imagination. And I think what we're seeing is so much more worldwide collaboration that you're talking about how libraries are in a position and librarians are in a position to be able to advance what's going on. Why librarians? What makes us any different from the rest of the people that are out there who are the specialists in their field that we're trying to find the information answers for our customers? Sorry, I'm getting a little tongue-tied here. But what makes us so special? Why do we think we're so special? Or are we the stegosaurus in the room?
You know, it's heretic. No, heresy. No, I think it's a great question, and for me, it's the idea that one, we're distributed and local. Two, we often are consumers of information which don't have necessarily this corpus that we're sitting there trying to protect. We have our collections, but not necessarily in terms of intellectual property. We have this focus on user connections. We, you know, I think there's a lot of it, and I think one of the things is I've been noticing as I'm going to more and more talks that we're past the fear and loathing days. We live in a post-search engine days, and we have the ability to renegotiate a compact with our communities and say we're not now the font of all information. And frankly, there are good reasons to go to search engines. But I think the answer is we're also one of the last remaining, at least in North America, one of the last remaining credible agents. That people love their libraries, and they love their libraries for books, but they also love their librarians, which is amazing to me because we don't even let them know who we are. But I think so. For me, it's a question of we're not going out of business anytime soon. We still have the social good on our side, even in the corporate setting. God help us. We've been in this world of multiple information sources, shopping them, working them for a given context for our entire history, whereas we're trying to see search engines trying to figure out local. What's local search? What's this search? Local them. Mm-hmm. The people walking to my doors, the people I get phone calls from. We need to get that bigger. But I think that puts us in an opportunity stage and not in a irrelevancy stage.
Well, I think we need to get it bigger. I think that that's one of the biggest problems that we face, is that libraries as entities don't market really very well to our non-users. And I mean, I can walk down the street and I can ask 20 people, 100 people, and ask them, when's the last time you used a database in your library? And they're going to say, what?
Right, and then ask them, what do you think of your library?
They'll love their library, but they don't even know the resources that we have.
That's right. And so that's where if we don't solve, you're right, if we don't solve that problem, we become the stakes.
Yes.
We become a cute boutique. But if, on the other hand, we engage and say we are not only for the community, we are the community, where our users can come in, give them a shelf in a physical space.
Give them a shelf.
Where they can organize their own material. Give them the ability to come in and comment. Library thing is a great example with tagging. Because, as I understand it, their analysis when they looked at Amazon's tagging and LibraryThings tagging is, in Amazon, no one tags because it's like we're inviting them in to organize our shelves for us. And LibraryThings, they're your shelves. Are your shelves their shelves, or are your shelves what the librarians think the community wants? So you're right. We have, but it's, I like to think of things as an opportunity. What a great opportunity! And we're still here. We're still standing. We're still relevant. And we've got. This is an obligation on our community to lead in this domain and not simply consume, consume, consume.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was to get that conversation going.
Very good conversation.
Please, Catherine.
Yes, I am.
I know we all sort of use the shorthand, you know, I like 10K Wizard or Delicious or Dig or Lobster. I'm wondering if you could talk about the more formal factors you use in deciding what you like, sort of in going forward, and how can we evaluate what we should like?
Can I get my data out? That's number one. If there's ways to be able to own what you're putting into it, the value proposition increases pretty dramatically. And RSS is a nice way to do that.
I'd say in terms of what you like, it depends on whether you're doing it for yourself or whether it's something you're doing for someone else. Certainly at our busy reference desk, if one person comes up and asks a question, I'll go to the 10K Wizard example since you mentioned it. Somebody comes up, they want to know about one particular publicly traded company and they have no budget. There's no way you would do 10K Wizard, no matter how much you like it. You would go to the SEC's website because it has the data. It's not pretty, but it has the data. It's readable. It's free. Somebody else comes up, wants to do some sort of an analysis on an arcane topic that would be covered in 10K filings, then you go to 10K Wizard. They have a budget. You can do complex searches. So it's contextual.
My criteria just doesn't, I can get down to the nitty-gritty where it's coming out of theory and part of duality, but ultimately is, does it produce knowledge? And the idea of learning impact that comes from a context, which is why did you need it, what's the impact of that factor, but it's ultimately, what is your information need, did you fill it? Satisfaction is a really crappy metric. It's always been a crappy metric. Relevance is a much tighter metric, and we ultimately need to get to impact factors about what effect did it have.
Well, also in a world where there's so much competition and online stuff, it's what don't you like, right? And what's left. And it's so easy to switch to something else. I mean, it's really, not being good enough is really true, and not being bad, because as soon as you start not getting what you want from one thing, you're gone, right?
And noticing also how quickly in a web world things change. If you asked me a couple of weeks ago what my favorite search engine was for blogs, I would have said Technorati. And now that they've improved Technorati, I'm in the market for a new search engine.
Were you talking about vendor resources or just in general the sort of things that you're looking for?
Really what I was looking for was a more sort of formal hierarchy for evaluating information tools. So, why wouldn't you like Technorati, for instance, is what I was sort of getting at. I mean, and, part of it's just, does it smell right? But part of it's, there's a more formal matrix we sort of have underlying. And I was wondering how much thought you put into that sort of thing.
Relevance, authority, cost. Those three are always the big ones.
Hi, good morning. I have a question regarding what do we actually want, for example, to ask vendors and products. We all have databases and we want to get the most out of them. We see the iterative search tools, in the show everywhere. What do we actually want for our vendors to have in there? I mean, do we want iterative search? I mean, do we want classified results? And this is in terms of the user. I mean, what's easier for them? What's easier for us? What's the best way to get that to that information? Do we want the APIs?
Yes. the short-term answer. Is yes, you want the APIs because they're not going to be able to move fast enough as we come up with these ideas and develop them. So when you look at Ann Arbor that used Drupal, an open source package, to build what they thought was a cool idea using the XML layer out of III, that's cool. Now III, I hear, is putting in their licensing that you're not allowed to do that anymore. Right. So in the short term, we want flexibility, get your data out. That's normally done through APIs, web access, and XML sitting all the way around. In the longer terms, what we want is a better relationship with them so that we can hopefully be more agile. But break things into smaller and smaller pieces, give me APIs to get them so that I can recast and resort them together, because I'm the one who knows my community and what that interface should look like in that service. You know what the library community wants, which is delightful. However, I need to be able to zero in on the task that I need. Short term, that means smaller functionality aggregated together to the big system with APIs to each one of those small functionalities.
It's a complete two-way street, too. Like you said, you know the community. Instead of saying, what do you got? I'll take these. I mean, tell them what you need, right? And tell them what your users need. That's the way that, that they're going to get better and stay in business, and it's a competitive world out there.
And remixability, I think that's what users want. One of the things in Gawker, when you're searching Google, there's a way to add a citation to delicious, and I think that that's an unusual use in the library world. But anything that enables a sort of remixability is nice.
Thanks for a great question, by the way. I work for a vendor, and that's perfectly exactly the kind of thing I need to know about. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks again for this panel. I have to preface this by saying I kind of hate things like this because it really makes me think. It throws me but I was thinking about this, the title of this, Future of Information Retrieval. And I assumed I would come here and you would say, well, since millennials want information quickly and blah, 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 you know, like as time goes on, we seem to want things to happen more quickly, microwaves, etc. So assuming that, I was expecting to hear, like, we are developing these tools that will get you the authoritative information more quickly. And then I heard this gentleman talk about, well, there's people more interested in the conversations because it's diverse, they're non-traditional scholars, and that can add to that body of data. But then again, I'm thinking, well, and this is the clause and the synthesis I'm trying to do here is, well, we still need quality information quickly. Is the future going to be producing these tools? You know, is there the development and so on and so forth?
I've got to ask you one question though.
And I come from a database background, this is database development, and bottom line was index it so people can find it.
Please define quality for me now.
Quality and accurate. I mean, I come from also institution research, so people are doing, they want empirical data. The conversation, again, that's valuable too because they're adding qualitative sort of, but.
The reason I ask that question, first of all, I have to admit that I'm not the Pope's favorite guy because I'm a relativist. And what we've really found, first of all, quality needs a modifier, high, low, medium, bad. But the other one is it's situational. That's the number one thing we found. We had a system called Story Starter where people would get questions and answer them in their blogs. And we had an interesting question that was, why do teens abuse alcohol? And we had one person answer saying, teens abuse alcohol for lots of different reasons, including peer pressure, to look cool, and family problems. And the other one was this long citation of, you can look at this for teen drinking behavior. One was from a 16-year-old girl, and one was from a reference librarian. They are both authoritative and credible answers.
I hear you.
But only when you ask a different question. If you want a teen's perspective, the reference librarian is not a credible answer. So, I
totally valid.
Right.
So how we synthesize trying to get information quickly.
Yep.
And also the traditional sort of authoritative, for example, if you're looking for, give me information about such and such a person.
Right.
You now have to have the accurate dates where they were born and things like that, not just Wikipedia who someone can say something.
I've been writing about quality of information for the last 30 years, I think. And
so the future.
The future, you know, in some instances, the future isn't any different, and it's exactly what David is saying. You have to define what you mean by quality. Because, and I go back to the word contextual again, sorry about that, but the fact is, what we used to think about with quality, when all we had was the fee-based premium source databases, and at that time, when we were talking about quality, what we really were talking about was quality of the data. Did you spell the author's name right? Do you have the correct address for a company? Things like that. Those, quite frankly, are very easily fixed. They weren't then, but they are now. That's done. That's over with. Now the question is, did I give a person quality information that matches up with what they needed to know in the context of why they needed to know it? We do have issues with disambiguation. Again, we've had that for a long time. We've moved forward tremendously with that, where in the web search engines, you put in a word, and it comes back and says, did you mean? Or with the clustering sorts of things from Vivissimo's Clusty, where you put in, what was the formula? and it'll come back, and it'll cluster, and it'll have baby, it'll have race car, it'll have mathematics. So I think in many ways the technology has moved us ahead tremendously in being able to identify quality. But it remains quality in an information setting. Quality will always be in the eyes of the beholder.
And I think that's the future, is tools that recognize that, build that, and then allow, when it tells you this is relevant, it's based on something about you, not based on some abstract score.
I think that one thing I can say, and that we deal with this at Wilson all the time, and as David says, it's very relative. The question is, do you want recall or do you want precision? That's one of the first things that we want, that we look at Wilson. Which one of those is the quality answer? Well, we try to get a mix of them, of course. Most of our competitors opt for recall, and it's like walking into a flea market. There are some treasures in there if you can find them. We opt for the department store approach, where everything is organized and presented, and it's very easy to get the best thing because it's stacked right to the top. I'm afraid with our lease on this space is about to expire. Thank you all very much for coming here.